Winter is still upon us, but you have the warming hearth and caring joy that we bring in another episode of Guitar Talk with John and Jamie, because this is John.
This is Jamie coming to you live from Decatur, Georgia.
Decatur, Georgia. Is there such a place? I just want to check in.
There is such a place.
And why are we in Decatur, Georgia today?
Well, it's our tour.
Our tour. Yeah, our national tour. We're touring around the country, our national tour of places.
Yeah.
So today, I'm pretty excited because we posted, you know, please make suggestions about show episodes. And our dear friend, John Ziegler, shout out.
Yes, little Johnny Ziegler.
Little Johnny Ziegler made a very good suggestion. So we're going to follow up on that. And John's suggestion was talking about the art of improvisation and how one goes about learning to be an improviser and what's actually happening. Are you, you know, practicing scales and licks and regurgitating that, or are you inventing new stuff on the spot? And so we're going to talk a little bit about improvisation, because that's a big part of guitar playing these days, is being able to be a reasonable improviser, I would say.
Yeah, and it's interesting coming from my brother John Ziegler, who I respect immensely and who I think is one of the most gifted players out there right now, and who, like, I'm lucky because I get to play with him all the time. We play
every Monday night
at the Baked Potato every Monday, and I get to hear some of the things that he invents, and it's always interesting to me to hear other players and the way that they approach improvisation. And it's always kind of struck me that some players, if you're really going to define what improvisation is, it's like, how many people are truly improvising?
I don't think any.
100% of the time.
Holdsworth is about as close, I think, as you can get.
Yeah.
I mean, really, Henderson, Holdsworth, and even Henderson isn't on the same level as Holdsworth. I mean, I think they're both the pinnacle of doing this, and I know that...
That's a pretty bold statement.
I think Henderson is an incredible improviser and an incredible storyteller, but he's worked out a lot of really great stuff that you can hear, happening time and again. It's a little harder to hear Holdsworth's repeated things. I mean, there are licks within what he does, but generally he's pretty unique in his approach to things. That's my hearing of things. I love them both immensely as improvisers.
See, my statement would almost be the opposite of that, because, as you know, everyone who knows me knows that I revere Holdsworth more than pretty much, you know, food and sustenance and water and everything. But to hear Alan play, you hear a lot of, you know, you'll hear him do a lot of the scene. Like, when he gets into that zone, you can tell that he's kind of playing things that he's played before. Whereas with Scott Henderson, I've heard Scott play, and I've actually heard Scott play quite a bit recently, and he can play on things, on something as you know, like everything from a modal thing to, you know, like rhythm changes or like giant steps, and just pretty much play for a long time without repeating himself, without getting into...
That's true.
Without getting into similar, you know, repeating ideas or getting into things like, wow, I've never heard... He just keeps ramping it up, and every idea that he plays kind of leads to a new idea.
So then we should talk about improvisation for a second.
Yeah.
I think it's important to say, because what we're talking about is, like, you know, I mean, when I think about improvisation, and I'm not talking about just soloing, because, you know, there's 100 guys who can take a good 8-bar solo, right? I mean, a lot of the pop music of the, you know, 80s and, you know, there's, you know, guys like Richie Sambora who can take a really good pop rock guitar solo. I wouldn't consider him an improviser personally. Right. You know, I mean, does that seem inaccurate to you? I mean,
I'm hanging on.
Okay. So, but I mean, if I think about, like, improvisation, like, I think of, like, Michael Brecker, or I think of, you know, Cannonball Adderley or Oscar Peterson, or people who, so for me, I think the quality of improvisation is that within the context of playing music, based on this idea we've talked about before, is that it's a conversation, mm-hmm. that someone is able to, regardless of the rhythmic or harmonic foundation, tell a through line story that connects everything that's happening in a way that holds your interest. That's a good improviser, in my opinion, right? Like, the guy is actually tells a story that goes through, that weaves through the harmony and the rhythm, adds to it and builds and tells a story. And, you know, there's a lot of different types of improvisation. You can have the you know, just going way, way, way intense and then stopping, or building up to a thing and then dying down. I mean, there's all these, like, compositional theories. But essentially, they're telling a story, right? And I'm able to follow what they're doing, and it's interesting. It's not, because, I mean, you know, anybody can stand there and go plinkety, plinkety, plink for 25 minutes, but whether or not you're going to be interested for that 25 minutes or not is the critical difference.
It should have an arc to it. It should almost be like
arc. That was the word I was looking for before.
It should almost be a mini composition unto itself, which is what, like, the best solos are.
Soloing and improvisation, are we talking, because there's kind of, I think, a differential.
Okay. However, I think within the context of what most people talk about when they talk about improvisation, it's while you're improvising, while you're soloing, you're playing over a song.
Okay.
You're playing over a song that you do know.
Yes.
Hopefully, and then you are sort of spontaneously recreating melodic content on the harmonic structure of that tune.
I think of it that way.
So that's where I think, you know, improvisation is generally spoken of within the context of soloing.
Okay.
You know.
Okay, and I'm just trying to define it. Like, we're trying to define it as we're going.
You're not really going to be improvising while you're playing Stella by Starlight and playing the melody, you know.
Comping guys, but guys who are comping are improvising. Kenny Kirkland, when he would, you know, comp for people, was an extraordinary improviser.
He would be reharmonizing as...
Mitch Foreman. You listen to Mitch Foreman play. We've talked to him, and, you know, when he's comping and he's grooving and he's doing stuff, that's a form of improvisation as well.
But what I'm talking about is when you're playing the melody of a song.
Okay. No, I'm just
trying
to... You're
not really improvising when you're playing the melody to a song that's already written.
Okay. So you're improvising over a framework that has already an established melody, maybe like a head, right? Right? Yeah. That's the thing. And then you are given the responsibility to tell your own story for whatever given period of time that is.
Yeah. Now, here's the question. When you get into an environment where you're going to be soloing, let's just say soloing, since that's what, you know, especially when you're talking about like standards, jazz standards, real book type tunes, you know, the song's written, there's the melody, there's the chords. So you're not, you know, unless you're going to completely reharmonize a song spontaneously on the bandstand and probably get some looks from, you know, the guy who's charged with actually playing the melody, you know, you know, what sort of preparation goes into that? Are you mapping out in your brain or in your ear? You know, it's like, okay, I'm going to start with this, and then I'm going to play this, and when I get to this chord, I'm going to make sure I play this lick, and then when I get to the second ending, I'm going to make sure, and it modulates into this, I'm going to make sure I play this lick that I kind of worked out earlier.
Like, well, we'll get in that context. Yes.
That to me is not improvisation.
Well, okay, but. Okay, so given that context, because, I mean, I can think of a lot of different other contexts for improvisation where, you know, there's vocabulary and dialect. You know, like if I'm in a funk environment or a blues environment or a fusion environment or whatever, the dialect changes depending on the thing, like especially like it's a one chord tune, you know, or a simple progression. Like, I've heard Scott Henderson improvise over all blues where I was just like, I didn't quite know what was happening, and it was so beautiful. Mm-hmm. So given the context that you've described, I think that certain preparatory thing is that you break the tune down into its component elements, and then also into like the guys like Cannibal Adderley and Michael Brecker. I've read articles where they talk about the idea of it's not just the chord sequence that's the given structure of the tune that they're breaking down, mm-hmm. but it's all the ancillary possibilities of how I got from chord A to chord B and the chords that I can imply in between that still make the sort mm-hmm. the chord progression work. But I've still got the overall framework of the building that I'm walking up the stairs in. You know, I mean, the blueprint is still there. And all the guys I know who are serious bebop guys all say the same thing is, you know, we watched Matheny give a lecture on talking about it. He does this thing where he plays the thirds and the sevenths through the whole chord sequence until he knows all over the neck where the third and the seventh is. Mm-hmm. Or my friend Andreas Oberg, who's a really amazing jazz guitar player, he breaks it down so that he knows where all the combined arpeggios structurally are, so that he can basically see like almost like a grid, mm-hmm. you know, like the map of the tune is like a grid across the thing, mm-hmm. and that's preparation. And then within that framework, it's bouncing around in ways where your ideas are being created to form new ideas. Now, there's two schools, because there's one is I can map my shit out so that, you know, I can play the same thing pretty much every time. I don't think that's improvisation. But then I can know the tune so well. I think, okay, this is just stepping aside. I think in order to improvise on jazz, you have to know what's coming so that you can know where to go. Because, like, well, you know.
Yeah, that was a, you know, when you're learning, when you're a beginning improviser or you're just starting to get into that world, you know, a lot of improvisation when you really start getting into the studying improv and learning it, it's generally done in the context of like jazz tunes and standards, because that's how most people that are, you know, people that are teachers of improvisation, they'll teach in that context. But that was always the thing for me that was really amazing. I would listen to, you know, like Wes Montgomery, or I'd listen to, you know, like a, you know, Miles Davis, or any of these records that you're listening to at that time when you're starting to get into it. And it's like, you know, but these guys are doing it so effortlessly and playing over it. And then I had this teacher at the time, and he's like, yeah, but you got to understand, these guys have been playing these tunes for years. They have, their knowledge of the song is so intimate that they don't even really have to think of the changes anymore. Like, they're not thinking when they're, you know, like when they're playing, I mentioned Stella by Starlight earlier, when they're not thinking, you know, E minor 7 5 5, A7 to A minor 7, you know, they're like, that's not really going by in their mind. They're just, their knowledge of the song is such that they're just, those changes, the actual, you know, like written changes have kind of, they're it's kind of faded into the background, and they are just hearing what the chords are, and they know what they are.
Right.
So they're therefore able to just, you know, play, because they just kind of like those changes are so ingrained in them.
Yeah, but there's that, and then, I mean, Charlie Parker talked about it directly. He said, you know, I've broken this down to the point where I've forgotten it.
Yeah.
You know, he's learned it to the point where he's forgotten it, and there is a case to be made. You cannot ever look at Charlie Parker stuff and not go, he's completely aware of all. I mean, it's like Bach, man. Yeah. I mean, it's all like worked out. Like, okay, I know these changes really well, but each time I do it, I can freshly apply a new line, because I'm trying to get from point A to point B.
Yeah.
I know what's coming, so I'm here, so I got to get to there.
Yeah,
and I'm making gestures that people can't see with my hands, which would probably be more articulate. But, you know, it's like it's. I think there is a studied preparation. So that goes to the point of, well, what is preparation? Because there's a mechanical side, which is getting your hands to move and knowing what works and what doesn't. But, you know, I used to do this thing with students where I would take a G7 chord, right? And I would say all 12 notes except for, and even for the F sharp, there's a case that could be made that you can make the F sharp work on a G7 chord.
Sure.
You know, and it's like I said, here's what, you know, the context of all 12 notes are: root, flat 9, natural 9, you know, sharp 9, third, fourth, you know, raised fourth, fifth, flatted sixth or raised fifth, sixth, flat seventh, major seventh, and the thing. All those notes work. So the question is, well, if all 12 notes work, then how am I creating melodies? And I think that there's, okay, so from my point of view, there's two sides to preparation. Knowing the history of what's worked, like listening to conversations that have already occurred, and then practicing in such a way that you're developing a facility with options. I think practicing to improvise is you generate options.
Right.
So that, you know, like, I mean, I know I have my licks, because I'm not a real true improviser. I do my best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I definitely try and let go and follow through lines.
Yeah.
But I know that, you know, connecting ideas, I'm going to throw in that same thing.
There's going to be some things that are laboratory tested that you've.
Yes. And especially because my field is blues. Like, I'm within the harmonic framework of the blues, so that I don't get bored, I'll do different things. But I know that I can connect my ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And then remember the conversation we had a couple weeks ago where we were talking about phrasing a little bit? And we talked about this idea of sentences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you're talking in sentences, like when we're teaching students how to improvise, and this idea of like, well, say a sentence, like, I really wish I could improvise, and then make that into a melody. Ba-ba-da-ba-da-da-da-da-da. You know, and we had that idea. I think that the guys who are really advanced are so fluid because they've practiced all these options. Cannonball Adderley to me is like the most fluid, rhythmic, melodic guy I can, you know, except for maybe Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't think of anybody who's just like, so I know where time is, but I don't have to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
I know what all my scale options are. And then again, the whole scale option thing becomes whether that's a real thing or a myth. Like, I practiced all these scales, but the truth is I've just been generating all these options for my ears to grab hold of.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to let go of all those frameworks and see what happens.
Yeah. that's a good start. That's a good springboard for like, okay, you know, for the written harmony, these are what the chords and the accepted scales would be, and then you can kind of go from there.
That's an important sentence. So accepted scales. What does that mean to you when you hear that?
Well, just ones that have become sort of ones that are, they're not too dissonant. They're not too outside. You know, it's a scale that is kind of based around the harmonic framework of that. You know, contains all the important chord tones. It contains all the chord tones. Plus, the non-chord tones are ones that that just sound pleasing to the ear. You know, like a minor seven chord. You know, playing a Dorian scale on that. Okay, it's, you know, it has all of the chord tones. It has 1 flat 3 5 flat 7, and then it's got the, you know, the other chord tones in there are the nice ones. It's got a ninth. It's got the major six, which was, you know, one of my favorites.
And we've discussed this. Yes, I know.
So, you know what I mean? But then there's a host of other things you can do on a minor seven chord. A lot of it has to do with what's the context. What is that chord within the context of that song? What's it functioning as? Is it, you know, where's it coming from and where's it going? And then that's going to open up another set of doors for like, well, in that case, you can play, you know, is this a dominant seven chord, a five chord moving to a major chord, you know, or is it a five chord moving to a minor chord? If so, then there might be different things that you want to play on that five chord. You know what I mean? Like that kind of stuff.
But there's other, I mean, even the school, I mean, when I was a kid, I was like 20, I took a lesson with John Scofield, right? Mm-hmm. And we were playing blues in F minor. Mm-hmm. And he was like, okay, so I want you to solo in F sharp. And I was looking at him like, well, I don't know what you're smoking, but I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that. And I tried my best, mm-hmm. you know, to understand what that meant. How do I make melodies that are, you know, the tonic note of the scale I'm in is the flat nine in a minor key. F minor, mm-hmm. and the tonic note of the scale, right. F sharp minor. And I was like, you know, and I tried, I mm-hmm. couldn't do it, but he could. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if he was consistent. I mean, it's 30 years ago, so I don't know, yeah. I mean, how good it was that he was doing it. But there was that whole school of, you know, superimposition and,
yeah.
you know, what's actually happening. And then that comes back to the 12 note rule, mm-hmm. which is really, you know, I mean, Miles's thing, which was my favorite sentence was, you know, if he hits a note that people might think is questionable, he hits it again. Just to show that right. he did it on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. it's like,
I love that.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like, they're really, I don't know. It's like, as I'm getting older, I'm not finding a lot of wrong notes. I mean,
I adopt that rule every time I play.
Yes. We have to adopt that rule. Yeah, I've had quite a few where I've hit the note twice. You know, and then, but then there's guys like Oscar Peterson who, you know, he had a lot of licks for sure, but he was able to jumble them around in this way that he was able to tell this incredibly dynamic, beautiful story through every, you know, tune he would swing through with this mm-hmm. great groove. And okay, and that's the other thing. It's like we're talking about choice of notes a lot, but rhythmic sensibility.
Yeah, that's a huge part of.
We were talking about that earlier today. Like, what makes a player unique and interesting is like. Well,
and that's I think what it is. It's like that, and that's what gives a player their character, and that's what gives any improviser their character is how they're interpreting time and how they're grooving, how they're swinging, how they're not swinging, how they're, you know, the way that they're.
It's interesting. How they're interpreting time. It's a really yeah. interesting idea to me.
Yeah.
How does one interpret? Because, I mean, it's true. Every player has a unique sort of brand. Like Matheny's got that sort of bouncy on top of it thing. And Brecker's got that really laid back, but, you know, double time sort of amazingness.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, the like George Benson's got that just swinging snap vocal yeah. quality. And I know you're not a huge fan, but Robin Ford's got his own thing that's very identifiable. Henderson's got that. He's got the thing where it's like space. He does these great phrases, but then he stops. He's not into like super long, like unending lines.
Yeah.
He likes to stop and like kind of gather his forces and, oh yeah. And then I'm going to tell you this, then I'm going to take you here and kind of build on that.
Yeah. Scott's got almost like a motif development type thing where he'll play something and then he'll kind of like develop that. And then that's his phrase. And then he'll.
Yes.
Play something else.
I like motivic development, I think.
It's great. I mean, that's sort of the area that I try to come from because I've never really, you know, like I wasn't born into the jazz subculture. And so, you know, I was someone that sort of came to it, did a lot of studying of it. But now when I approach a tune, that's what I'll try and do is try and think of it in terms of like, you know, some sort of little bite-size, you know, melodic idea that I can then develop over the course of, you know, a few chords and then maybe when the chords change, you know what I mean? I can like take what I was playing and move it and sort of then, you know, take it from there. The other night, see, I think that, and I know I've said this before, and I've said this to students, that true improvisation takes place at slower velocities. You know, when you're playing slower, that's where true improvisation is really going to happen, if it's going to happen at all. The second you start playing faster, it's like they're inversely proportional. You know, so it's like that. True improvisation is actually going to decrease as your speed increases.
For most people, yeah, I agree with
that. When you, because as you're increasing, then you're going to get back more into what Sonny Cher called your laboratory tested, you know, licks and ideas and lines, stuff that you played at home and that you've worked out,
right.
Pattern based stuff.
Yeah.
And it's true. The other night at the Baked Potato, we were playing and some people got up and we were doing that Miles Davis tune, Solar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fun tune to play, but it's a 12-bar form. But the way that the chords kind of cycle through it, it's a little disjointed feeling. And I was playing on it, and I was trying to develop some ideas. And it just, to me, you know, it wasn't happening. I was like, getting frustrated, you know. And it's like, and I can keep my place through that tune pretty good because it's a 12-bar form. So, you know. But I was like, I just didn't think I was connecting the chords right. So then, you know, I sort of go to my default place, which is playing my worked out 2-5-1 lines, you know, and just kind of cycling through the chords, you know. And it sounds cool because it's fast. And while on guitar, everything sounds better when it's fast. We all know that. Let's just agree on that, everyone.
No, I'm not agreeing that.
No, you have to.
I'm not. I refuse to agree.
But, you know, it's cool because it's fast, but it's like I've left the improvisational building.
Well, you know, Ted talked about this. Ted said this very clearly. He said there's three ways he looks at it.
Ted Green, everybody.
Sorry. Yeah. It's always Ted Green.
Yeah.
Anytime the word Ted comes up in this show, it's always Ted Green.
Yeah.
There is no other Ted. And not even the Ted talks would ever come up in this.
We could be talking about Ted Danson, though, and I just want to make sure that the people at home understand that we're not talking about, you know, Ted Danson.
Ted Green said that there were three ways. He said either the hands run it, the mind runs it, or the ears run it. You know, and he was like, he said he would always try different things. Like sometimes on nights where the ears weren't hearing it, he'd let his hands run it, you know, or his eye, you know, his eye and hands. Or sometimes he would let the mind run. He goes, oh, I know I can do this. I know I can do that. And he would see if that worked. And then he's just sometimes he'd let go and completely listen and just let the whatever his ears were leading him to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the thing is the worked out stuff, like, my community, you have a really special thing is that you've been in one of the top technical bands that has a very big improvisational framework, which is Zappa Plays Zappa. Plus, you play every Monday night at the Baked Potato, where the fundamental purpose driving force of the evening is improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my community has been the blues community. And I'm frustrated by the blues community a lot of times because aside from the fact that I don't particularly play the old style traditional blues because I've done that for a long time and it gets kind of old for me. But there's this sort of thing where a lot of regurgitation happens. Like there's a lot of stock phrases, like guys who want to sound like Stevie Ray or guys who want to sound like, you know, B.B. King or guys who want to sound like Buddy Guy or, you know, Freddie King or all these guys, you know, Jimmy Reed. There's this stock palette of licks. Like I did a thing. I've never told this story. I went to the Guitar Center, you know, blues competition, right? And I got eliminated in the first round by a guy who couldn't play because I was playing too melodically. That's what I was told afterwards. I was playing too melodically.
Playing too much melody there.
Yeah, it was like your lines were like too melodic. And I was like, it wasn't bluesy enough.
Yeah.
And I was like, and the guy who won couldn't play.
You don't sound enough like John Mayer.
Yeah.
Now get out.
Yeah, that was kind of actually what was said. Actually, it wasn't John Mayer. It was Joe Bonamassa. And I responded with, Joe Bonamassa is not really a blues guy to me. You know, I mean, it's like if I think of blues guitar, I don't really leap to Joe Bonamassa. And the guy was like, you should have sounded more like Joe Bonamassa. And I was like, I appreciate the feedback, but I'm who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing, you know, improvisers have their own voice. But it's like these stock phrases in the blues community are little things that people connect to tell a story that everyone's already said. So I don't think of that as improvisation anymore.
Yeah.
And in the jazz community, you know, I think these guys work out a lot of their stuff, a lot of it. And then they're able to jumble it around. Like Holdsworth talks about this jumbling around thing.
Right.
And now I kind of lost my train. I had a train. There was a reason I was telling that story. There was a reason.
But I think you just wanted to brag that you were in the Guitar Center blues competition.
And got blown out in the first round.
I think you just wanted to sort of, you know, name drop a little bit. I think
that's that was my goal.
That was your agenda.
That was my agenda. but if we're talking about improvisation now together, you and I, because we both played together quite a bit, like when we're playing, when is the most comfortable for you when you're improvising? Like, is it when you know the material really well and you go in, or is it when you're like, wow, I've just got to jump in on this and I'm off the cuff and I've just really got to go for it and be really careful?
Well, it depends on what it is. If it's a song with changes, then yeah, I can't be comfortable unless I know the tune, unless I have some kind of knowledge of
what qualifies knowing the tune to you.
Well, having learned it previously, and you know, like if it's a difficult song with a lot of changes, you know, Star Eyes or something like that, and John Ziegler will know what I'm talking about with Star Eyes. You know, if it's a song like that, that's gonna be a tough one for me to just like, oh, I don't know it, but you know, I can fake it, you know, because it's not really a fake it kind of a song.
Sure.
But if it's something that's
who's tuned to Star Eyes?
I can't remember who wrote it.
So whoever knows, who send us in a comment. Okay.
It's in the real book. I mean, okay. It'd be simple to look up. It's, you know.
But it's a lot of changes?
Yeah, a lot of changes. It might be one of those, you know, who's the guy? Ned Washington? Is that? It might be one of those kind of, okay. You know, that.
Lots of chords.
Yeah, lots of chords. And you know, or if it's more of a modal thing, then yeah, I like just jumping right in. I love songs that have a couple of changes. Like on Monday nights, we'll do a lot of songs like some of our favorite stuff to do, some of those Freddie Hubbard tunes from the 70s, like
Povo.
Like Povo.
I love Povo. You taught me Povo.
It's one of my favorite songs to play because it's like, it's got changes, but they're not crazy changes. It's like, it's a 12 bar form. So it's, you know,
two chords at the end, the major 7-sharp-11 chords.
Yeah. And you know, it's just so much fun to play them because it's like, you can't just sit there in one key and just sort of like, you know, sit in the box and play. You got to kind of, you know, play.
And connect it.
And connect them and connect them in there. And it's, and the chords are written in such a way that they're just bizarre enough to make it challenging to connect. And I love that. That's the kind of shit that I really love that a lot. And I love hearing the other guys playing it and hearing a guy like, you know, a lot of people, you know, when they think of John Ziegler and they're familiar with him, they think of this guy that's just like, oh man, he's just this, you know, super aggressive, like rock player. But when you hear him play on songs like that, see, that's like the John Ziegler that I love. You know, I mean, I love.
Are there multiple John
Ziegler?
There
are. He's like Sybil. You know?
multiple
John. Because he can take all that power and all that style of his, but he can harness it into a song like that that's got those really cool changes and he can like weave it around those. And I love that. I would almost just assume not even play and just listen to him. And then we have like Doug Webb has been playing with us a lot, who's probably one of the most gifted saxophone players in LA right now. He's just an amazing improviser. And the stuff that he will do, he just blazes new trails every time on these tunes.
So this is a big topic.
Yeah.
And we may have to go to a second episode because my thinking is, I mean, there's two sides to improvisation, which John aptly pointed out in his request for the show, was that there's preparation. And then there's actually being in the moment. And then there's the quality of, well, there are nights when you are in the moment, and then there's nights where your mind is racing because you're thinking you suck. And, you know, there's all these qualifiers about how improvisation works and what makes good improvisation. For example, like, I really am not that into Ornette Coleman, but I will sit and listen to Cannonball Adderley or Oscar Peterson until the cows come home. James Blood Omer doesn't really do a lot for me.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the new jazz younger guys that are big. Oh, you were telling me some of the names because I was being spacey because I didn't know who any of the younger guys were. But you know, that some of it's interesting to me, and just some of it's just not. And that's an interesting quality to improvisation is that what is it about what somebody does that attracts us? Because there are a lot of people who aren't that interested in Scott Henderson, but would rather listen to Mike Landau or Robin Ford, but they would not want to hear Alan Holdsworth. Or there are guys who, you know what I mean? There's something about the way these guys and something about how that connects. So that might be another episode is, what is it about improvisers that you connect with? How about that? We can talk about that.
Yeah. So, and why?
And why? So send us your thoughts on that. Let's continue this discussion. Let's do that. Talk to us about how you guys learn to improvise. Are you improvisers? What do you like about improvisation? Who do you listen to? What are your, you know, influences about this? And that's something we didn't touch on today, like transcription and listening to other improvised solos to learn how to find your way through a story. Like I remember transcribing Coltrane's solo to So What when I was like 18 years old so that I could, you know, figure it out. I never used it. You can't,
right?
But
exactly.
But it's you know, it's like that kind of mentality. So talk to us about this. Don't forget to go out to the iTunes site and please post reviews. We're really appreciative of that. John, your prize CD will go out to somebody. In fact, John has donated his CD, which because his topic made it to air. So what we're going to do is the first person who goes out to iTunes and posts a review and mentions that they heard, you know, this episode in John Ziegler gets John's CD. How's that? And then if you're really hip, the first maybe five people who post reviews might get copies of my CD or Jamie's coming CD, because Jamie has a CD coming out fairly soon.
Should be out in about 5 years.
At the rate we're going.
It's going to be out sooner than that.
The rate we're going, that's about how long it's going to take people to
get. I'd be more than happy to give out a few CDs.
Yeah. And we're really interested in you guys participating in the discussion. The point of Guitar Talk is it's a conversation. So let us hear what your thoughts are. So we're going to just ramble our way out here. Where were we again? What city were we?
We're in Decatur today.
Decatur.
I'm going to go to a Waffle House.
Waffle House. Chicken and waffles.
No, it's just a waffle. It's called a Waffle House. Every off-ramp.
Every off-ramp from Decatur.
I'm going to go get some grits and get some waffles and some corned beef hash.
Wait, hash.
Corned beef.
Not Amsterdam. So we're just talking our way out, and thanks for listening to Guitar.
Yeah, thanks, John. Okay. John Z.